From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
An immigration raid in Tallahassee resulted in more than 100 people being detained. Community members are speaking out.
If not us, then who will? Like, someone has to hold them accountable.
Also this week, John Thrasher, former FSU president and former speaker of the Florida House, is remembered.
He's a tough guy, but he was always cool under pressure, never lost his temper, was always respectful.
And some members of the FAMU community are preparing to fight against a newly elected university president they worry poses a threat to their university's mission.
People like you, myself, others, stand up, show courage, and others will see that, and then that builds momentum.
I'm Regan McCarthy. This is Capitol Report. Starting off tonight, we hear about a crackdown on illegal immigration in Florida's capital city. Law enforcement officers, some wearing masks, used zip-tie handcuffs to detain more than 100 undocumented immigrants Thursday. As busloads of immigrants were taken away, onlookers gathered. Some held signs, a few yelled out, most stood quietly and watched.
It was sort of eerily silent when I showed up.
Morgan Orozco was among the group. She says she felt helpless, standing on the other side of a caution tape line.
I had nothing in my power that I could do to stop this injustice that was happening right in front of me.
Orozco, who says one of her parents is Cuban, heard about the immigration crackdown from a friend. She says she went there hoping her presence and that of other community members might help create a greater sense of accountability for the officers involved.
If not us, then who will?
Orozco is opposed to many of the recent state and federal efforts to crack down on illegal immigration. A news release on the Immigration and Customs Enforcement website says several law enforcement agencies, including Florida Highway Patrol, were involved in the sweep. Officials say one person was taken into custody for resisting arrest and is being charged with four counts of assault on law enforcement officers. Governor Ron DeSantis, who has championed efforts to crack down on illegal immigration, touted the Tallahassee raid on social media, saying the participation of state law enforcement, including Florida Highway Patrol, had a huge impact on the sweep. It's an idea he's repeated before.
This is really the model for what needs to be done all throughout the country.
DeSantis held a press conference a few weeks ago to highlight another recent immigration crackdown effort. DeSantis says he credits sweeping immigration legislation passed earlier this year for what he sees as successful efforts to fight illegal immigration in Florida. John Thrasher led a remarkable life. President of Florida State University, Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives, soldier, lawmaker, businessman, and family man. He died today at the age of 81. Margie Menzel has this remembrance.
Thrasher had a special blend of leadership qualities. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush describes himself as a rookie governor when he started working with the then House Speaker.
Were it not for John Thrasher, whatever success that I had, that we had as an administration, wouldn't happen the first few years. He took me under his wings and was an incredible partner. And I got to see true leadership up close.
Although Thrasher was a powerful man, Bush says, he was always gracious.
He's a tough guy, but he was always cool under pressure, never lost his temper, was always respectful. You know, we had a big majority as Republicans, but he always let the other side, other voices be heard. He was respectful to people.
Thrasher was known for his fierce pride in Florida State long before he became its president. He earned his bachelor's degree in business there in 1965. He earned two Bronze Stars in Vietnam. He was honorably discharged as a captain in 1970, then returned to FSU, earning his law degree with honors in 1972. Thrasher was the 90th Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives. And Bush says Thrasher's experiences in the military and the legislature prepared him well for the presidency of FSU.
You have to have a degree of empathy for the other side, which we've lost a little bit in our politics, but John exemplified that. And I think those skills directly transferred over to a public leadership job like it being president of FSU.
Thrasher was FSU's president from 2014 to 2021, during which time FSU rose to number 18 among public universities in the U.S. News and World Report rankings. Here he is in 2022, the year after he retired.
We were able to really motivate folks toward, you know, student success. We were able to tell our story and find students who wanted to come here. I mean, last year I was here, we had 75,000 applications.
His successful presidency included a fundraising campaign that netted $1.16 billion.
I'm really proud of Florida State, proud of what we've accomplished. We have a great faculty. They're getting better and better every year. And I think the new president, I think, is on a track to even accelerate all of that and make it even better than it is.
Skip Foster of Hammerhead Communications was publisher of the Tallahassee Democrat during Thrasher's leadership of FSU. He recalls Thrasher once asking him not to publish something.
And I had to say, you know, John, I would love to be able to say yes to your request, but I just can't do it. And he understood. And the next time I saw him, it was like nothing had ever happened. So he knew that even though we had kind of semi-adversarial roles, that we could still be friends and treat each other with respect. And that's how he led his whole life. That was just a microcosm of the way he led.
Thrasher was just as successful as a businessman. He co-founded the Southern Group lobbying firm and was a partner there. He served as general counsel of the Florida Medical Association for decades. But for him, he said, it's less about the accomplishments than the impacts.
Numbers, you know, are just numbers. It's what happens, you know, to our kids when they leave, and they're doing great things all over the country.
He is survived by Jean, to whom he was married for 60 years. According to Florida State University, a private burial has been planned in Orange Park, Florida, and a celebration of life will be held August 19th at Florida State University's Ruby Diamond Concert Hall. I'm Margie Menzel.
Florida A&M University's foundation has postponed talks on outlining a bigger budget for President-elect Marva Johnson. The board met today to discuss her compensation package amid ongoing backlash to her selection. As Lynn Hatter reports, the move comes as FAMU supporters mull how to further block Johnson's appointment to the presidency ahead of her confirmation vote by the Florida Board of Governors.
Johnson was named FAMU president by the school's trustees earlier this month. The move was immediately derided by supporters. Johnson is a lobbyist for Charter Communications, one of the largest cable companies in the United States. She has deep ties to the state's Republican leadership. And while she has served on the Florida Board of Education, which oversees K-12 public schools and colleges, she has no experience operating within universities. This, coupled with a cloudy search process, has raised red flags among many FAMU faithful. The fight over the future of the school is echoing in Washington, D.C. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries recently spoke on it.
It's my suspicion that she will not last long at the institution. She will be a failure.
A trustee who voiced concerns about Johnson's last-minute addition to the finalist list was removed. Another installed a day before the final vote. The DeSantis administration has played a role in Johnson's selection, further fueling distrust as the governor continues his anti-woke, anti-DEI crusade. And FAMU stakeholders fear Johnson will try to dismantle the school by giving up programs like pharmacy, nursing, and law. These programs have been criticized by the state university system governing board over their exam passage rates. Members of the Florida Board of Governors are appointed by DeSantis. Johnson, say critics, poses an existential threat to FAMU's legacy of nurturing black and brown talent. Amid it all, two resistance camps are taking root. One side is mulling how to negotiate and work with Johnson. The other is preparing to continue fighting her confirmation. Lawrence Humphreys, a member of the FAMU Foundation, is in the fight camp.
People like you, myself, others, stand up, show courage, and others will see that, and then that builds momentum.
On Friday, FAMU's foundation board weighed how much it can afford to spend on the new president. Johnson's $750,000 compensation ask is well above the $500,000 former President Larry Robinson was making. The financials of Johnson's proposal come at a time of increasing financial concerns for the university. Under state law, anything above $200,000 has to come from private money. Yet fundraising is down significantly, and markets are in turmoil. The school also still has current obligations, like fulfilling interim president Tim Beard's contract, the remaining salary for Robinson, and the addition of a new athletics director and head basketball coach. Foundation board members like Monica Williams-Harris are pushing back strongly on Johnson's ask.
I understand what the ask is. I understand what the range of salary is. Mm-hmm. But I think if we're going to be good stewards of the money, there's a different way to do this without allocating over $500,000 to presidential compensation when we have faculty members that have complained that they're not getting paid enough.
The board previously approved funding around $388,000 toward a presidential salary. Members want to wait for a formal proposal from trustees and are also awaiting additional budget asks from other departments across campus before making a decision. Even now, the fight over Johnson continues. Negotiations over her salary aren't finalized. The foundation would still have to approve that. And then there's the confirmation vote before the Florida Board of Governors. And if she gets through all of that, Humphreys says she'll still have to face a hostile campus that does not want her.
I think that, you know, it's very difficult to go into an environment where it's hostile towards you. The hostility's in the air. Even if people aren't outwardly hostile, but you feel it, you sense it, the stress that comes along with that. You got to go home, right? You don't feel good about what you're doing. Next thing you know, you're arguing with your family, you're kicking your dog, right? And that is draining. And at some point, someone who has been as successful as she has been in the private sector, you have to ask yourself, is it worth it?
And only Johnson can answer that. I'm Lynn Hatter in Tallahassee.
Hurricane season starts Sunday, but many residents haven't finished rebuilding after last year's storms. In fact, in southwest Florida, some are still rebuilding nearly 3 years after a direct hit from Hurricane Ian. Homes and businesses built right on the sand helped define the funky, eclectic identity of Fort Myers Beach. And it's partly why residents suffered so much devastation. That, plus warming waters, are fueling storms and making them stronger. WUSF's Jessica Mazaros brings us this update from the small town and shares how it can inform hurricane preparedness and recovery.
Journalist Charlie Whitehead has lived in the town of Fort Myers Beach for 40 years.
We're sitting in my front yard outside of my motorhome, on the lot that my grandparents bought in 1966.
We're surrounded by water. Out front is a bay that connects to the Gulf, and behind us is a man-made saltwater canal. Whitehead and his wife were almost finished fixing up their double-wide manufactured home 5 years after Hurricane Irma when Ian made landfall in September of 2022. The Category 4 storm brought up to 15 feet of storm surge and moved through the area slowly, beating on it for hours.
The home got picked up and moved sideways and dropped.
It was a total loss. Nearly every building on Fort Myers Beach was damaged, and 16 people were confirmed dead. After couch surfing for a while, Whitehead and his wife purchased a motorhome.
I'm ready now because when a storm comes, I get in my house and drive away. But that's not really a long-term solution.
So what does a long-term solution to surviving stronger storms look like?
It looks high.
Anita Saracita works on solutions as chair of the Fort Myers Beach Planning Board.
It means that almost every building that's built is going to be 15 or 20 feet off the ground to start with.
You can see it right now in the homes and businesses that are going up in Fort Myers Beach.
All of my neighbors are 15, 16, 18 feet off the ground. It's a real dramatic difference.
It's happening along the Tampa area's coast, too, after Hurricane Helene flooded areas with storm surge. Some Fort Myers Beach businesses that are staying at ground level have to flood-proof their buildings.
It's a very expensive endeavor, but it's good for retail because you'll walk up some stairs or go up an elevator for a restaurant, but you probably won't do that to buy a blouse or a dress.
And she says there's all kinds of red tape and zoning issues that go into rebuilding after a hurricane. Many residents in the Tampa Bay region are learning that now. Fort Myers Beach Councilman Scott Safford says this rebuilding process, it takes money and time.
After the hurricane, we thought that we could rebuild in 3 to 5 years and everything would be back to normal, but that's not the case.
More like 10 to 12 years, he says. Some folks are still trying to get paid out for their insurance claims nearly 3 years after Ian. And many who finally rebuilt, but at the ground level, got flooded again and again by Hurricanes Helene and Milton last year.
There's a lot of people that are just throwing their hands up going, man, I don't know if I can do this.
On top of that, residents and tourists, even now, don't have access to necessary goods and services in town.
So we don't have the dog groomer. We don't have a doctor. We don't have a chiropractor. We just had a bank open, our first bank.
In some ways, Ian's damage was a worst-case scenario. Helene skirted the coast, and Milton broke apart when it came ashore. Safford says there are lessons our region can learn from their experience with a direct hit.
I think the towns need to look, especially in the Tampa area, of how do you get these small businesses back and open as quickly as possible so that your residents and then future guests can have those conveniences.
Hurricane Ian has forced residents there to take storms seriously and shown them that water is their biggest threat. Longtime journalist and Fort Myers Beach resident Charlie Whitehead says there are popular places on the beach that are just gone.
And will not be back.
Like the beachfront cottages, mother-in-law apartments, and mom-and-pop businesses, all right on the sand.
It's going to be a different place, and I will forever miss the old place.
I asked him why remaining on this piece of property his grandparents purchased about 6 decades ago is so important to him.
I remember walking to the dock over there and getting in a flat-bottom boat with a kicker and my grandfather taking me out fishing when I was not 10 yet. It doesn't make any sense, but this is still home such as it is.
I'm Jessica Mazaros on Fort Myers Beach.
Insurance is a major factor at the forefront when we talk about hurricane season preparation. Lisa Miller is a property insurance consultant and Florida's former deputy insurance commissioner. She talked with Gina Jordan on Zoom about the increasing severity of storms in Florida and the need for resilient homes and proper insurance coverage.
When you think about Mother Nature and her wrath and the severe weather that we've seen with Mother Nature for the past 4 or 5 years, storms are getting worse. The weather's getting worse. The ferocity of the winds. Think about the floods. We can't take for granted the fact that we need to make our homes as resilient as we can. It's difficult. You know, we know about hurricane mitigation. We understand that it has to do with making our roof stronger to keep it on the top of our structure, strapping it down. We know that our windows need to be stronger. Impact-resistant windows are the way to go. We understand that we have a big garage door. We need to put a brace across it. And, you know, when you have an insurance claim, it can be very intimidating. First of all, you've had this major damage, and the first thing you think of is, do I have coverage? Do I have enough insurance coverage? Well, the time to think about that is not the day after the storm. And so here we are coming up to June 1, storm season, and I encourage all of your listeners that they call their insurance agent, and they say to their insurance agent, how am I looking? I added a new room to my house. I need to let you know that so I can up the coverage for my house. Or I put a new roof on and I want to make sure I get credit for that. Just check in with your insurance agent. You pay them a commission every year. Check in with them. Say, how much do I have? If my house were to go down to the ground, how much money am I going to get? And whatever number they give you, think about that. Can I rebuild my house for $250,000 or whatever coverage I have? That's what we have to do before the storm. The time to do that is not the day after the storm to wonder if you have enough coverage.
Yes. Okay, so we pay hurricane deductibles. We all are getting used to climate change and just the fact that things are just changing. So aside from just saying have as much insurance as you possibly can, what do people need to know who live in Tallahassee? What do we need to know?
What do Tallahassee residents need to know? Four things. First, know your coverage. You should be able to talk about what your max homeowner's coverage is, like you talk about the granite countertops that you put in your house. You should know that your house is covered for $320,000 or whatever that number is. And number two, you should know, is that enough to replace your home? Okay. Most important two things they can do before June 1st. Number three, if you need a new roof, which is the most important component of your house, when your roof blows off, your house is done. Don't believe that your shingles are 30-year shingles because they're not. There's no such thing as a 30-year shingle. I don't care what that warranty says. Because of the 115-degree heat that we have in August, asphalt shingles cannot handle that. And I don't want to hear people say, well, I'll wait for the storm and I'll get me a new roof. Do you know the anguish and the heartache it is for your roof to blow off your house and what it's like to go through a claim? You don't want to wish that on anybody. So replace your roof if you need to, even if it's on the borderline. You'll live easier. You'll breathe easier. And number four, if you have a claim, please don't sign anything from anybody that walks to your front door. People that you know come to your back door. Don't answer your front door. And for God's sake, don't sign anything that you haven't had a friend or a lawyer or your insurance agent look at. So four things. Know your coverage. What do you have? Number two, make sure that you review with your agent exactly you know what you have and update what you need to update on your policy. Number three, look at your roof. Have a roofer come out before the storm and look at your roof. If it's 8 to 10 years old and it's a shingle roof, how much life left is on your roof? If it's a couple years, start saving now. And number four, when the storm hits, don't sign anything. Take pictures of your damage. Work with your insurance company. Give them a shot to make it right. You can always hire a third party to help you, but at the outset, work with your insurance company.
Excellent. And do we need to have that wind coverage?
You have to have appropriate wind coverage. Absolutely. Have that conversation with your agent and say this. I know there's a difference between wind and hurricane coverage. Can you explain the difference to me and what does my policy do?
What is the recourse? Where do they go if they have concerns about their insurance?
They need
company?
To call. If you have a problem with not getting your insurance claim resolved, the first line of defense is to talk to the Florida Department of Financial Services, the Consumer Services Division. I do recommend that before you do contact the government, that customers do a chronology. Okay, I reported my claim on this day. I saw an adjuster on this day. It took 3 weeks for the adjuster to get back. Exactly the step-by-step of what occurred so that when you work with the government officials, it's all there laid out in black and white. This is no different than understanding what your health profile is, or if you're going to buy a new car, what are you going to buy? Understand what your insurance policy does for your home. Understand that before June 1st, please.
That was property insurance consultant Lisa Miller, Florida's former deputy insurance commissioner, speaking with WFSU's Gina Jordan. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Regan McCarthy. Finally this week, in Florida, drowning is the leading cause of accidental death for children ages 1 through 4. And for children with autism, the risk is even greater. That's partly because some children on the spectrum are drawn to the calming sensory effects of water, like the sound, the movement, the way it feels. But that natural attraction, combined with limited awareness of danger and challenges with swimming, can be deadly. To help families protect their children, Florida Atlantic University Center for Autism and Related Disabilities has released a new water safety guide tailored specifically for children with autism. WLRN's Amy Sanchez spoke with Jack Scott, the center's executive director.
Water safety for children is a critical issue in Florida. Why is it particularly important for children with autism?
Children with autism, and here we're talking about autism spectrum disorder, so there's a wide variety of severities within, but for many of them, their self-preservation skills are weak. They tend not to have, especially at the younger ages, not to have the kind of judgment that another child would have at the same young age to say, keep away from this water hazard, this pool, this pond. And with that, if they get away from parents or caregivers and they're unsupervised, they can be at grave risk for going into the water and drowning.
For children with autism, one of the major factors is wandering, also known as elopement. What does that look like in real life for families, and why does it happen so often with children on the spectrum?
We know it does happen quite often. Well more than 50% of young children with autism elope or wander. I've asked a number of young adults, adolescents with autism. In some cases, these would have been the kids who would have eloped when they were younger. I don't think there's any one reason why they do it. But for some, it's seeking a sensory experience. They want to go somewhere. They want to see something. They want to be around by the lake. There's some ducks there. They like that. For others, they may be escaping something. It may be that, oh, I'm supposed to go to the doctor this afternoon. I'm going to get shots. If they're even processing that, and they're thinking, oh, maybe it's convenient for me to split right now. But I think in the majority of cases, we really don't know why they're wandering, but they do. And they often are very skillful in detecting that no one is watching them for even a brief period of time. We often hear from parents, I only turn my back for a minute and the child can be out. So the elopement really does set the stage for this. The research we're seeing from Palm Beach by the Children's Services Council, done by John Burstein, an excellent job, April of 2024, just last year, 62% of the deaths in Florida for children with autism were the direct result of a wandering episode. So the wandering really is key to this in the majority of cases.
The guide recommends swimming as the first sport for children with autism. Why would you say that is such a priority?
I have to give credit to Dr. Levine at Joe DiMaggio for that little catchphrase. I think it's really good. But it should be the first sport for children with autism because it helps dramatically increase the safety of the child. And I think it brings the parents into contact with the importance of water safety as well. But a child who can swim, it's the best insurance. Although we need multiple layers. There is no one thing that does it. It's not one tracking device that will do it or a series of swim lessons, no matter how good they are. Multiple layers are required to ensure the safety of the child.
That was Jack Scott, the executive director at the Florida Atlantic University Center for Autism and Related Disabilities. He spoke with WLRN's Amy Sanchez about water safety for children with autism and what families can do to prevent drowning. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Margie Mandel, Tristan Wood, and Lynn Hatter. Thanks also to Jessica Mazaros, Amy Sanchez, and other public radio reporters around the state. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Evan Rossi. I'm Regan McCarthy. Join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.